New Lies for Old. The Communist Strategy of Deception and Disinformation. Anatoly Golitsyn. To the Memory of Anna Akhmatova. Conscience and Soul of Russian Literature. Editor's Foreword. Very rarely disclosures of information from behind the Iron Curtain throw new light on the roots of communist thought and action and challenge accepted notions on the operation of the communist system. We believe that this book does both these things. It is nothing if not controversial. It rejects conventional views on subjects ranging from Khrushchev's overthrow to Tito's revisionism, from Dubček's liberalism to Ceausescu's independence, and from the dissident movement to the Sino-Soviet split. The author's analysis has many obvious implications for Western policy. It will not be readily accepted by those who have for long been committed to opposing points of view. But we believe that the debates it is likely to provoke will lead to a deeper understanding of the nature of the threat from international communism and, perhaps, to a firmer determination to resist it. The author's services to the party and the KGB in the unusually long periods he spent in study, mainly in the KGB, but also with the University of Marxism-Leninism and the diplomatic schools, make the author uniquely well qualified as a citizen of the West to write about the subjects covered in this book. He was born near Poltava, in the Ukraine, in 1926. He was thus brought up as a member of the post-revolutionary generation. From 1933 onward, he lived in Moscow. He joined the communist youth movement, Komsomol, at the age of 15 while he was a cadet in military school. He became a member of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, CPSU, in 1945 while studying at the artillery school for officers at Odessa. In the same year, he entered military counterintelligence. On graduation from the Moscow School of Military Counterespionage in 1946, he joined the Soviet Intelligence Service. While working in its headquarters, he attended evening classes at the University of Marxism-Leninism, from which he graduated in 1948. From 1948 to 1950, he studied in the counterintelligence faculty of the High Intelligence School. Also, between 1949 and 1952, he completed a correspondence course with the High Diplomatic School. In 1952 and early 1953, he was involved, with a friend, in drawing up a proposal to the Central Committee on the Reorganization of Soviet Intelligence. The proposal included suggestions on the strengthening of counterintelligence, on the wider use of the satellite intelligence services, and on the reintroduction of the activist style into intelligence work. In connection with this proposal, he attended a meeting of the Secretariat chaired by Stalin and a meeting of the Presidium chaired by Malenkov and attended by Khrushchev, Brezhnev, and Bulganin. For 3 months in 1952-53, the author worked as a head of section in the Department of the Soviet Intelligence Service responsible for counterespionage against the United States. In 1953, he was posted to Vienna, where he served for 2 years undercover as a member of the apparat of the Soviet High Commission. For the first year, he worked against Russian emigres, and for the second against British intelligence. In 1954, he was elected to be a deputy secretary of the party organization in the KGB residency in Vienna, numbering 70 officers. On return to Moscow, he attended the KGB Institute, now the KGB Academy, as a full-time student for 4 years, graduating from there with a law degree in 1959. As a student of the Institute and as a party member, he was well placed to follow the power struggle in the Soviet leadership that was reflected in secret party letters, briefings, and conferences. From 1959 to 1960, at a time when a new long-range policy for the Bloc was being formulated and the KGB was being reorganized to play its part in it, he served as a senior analyst in the NATO section of the Information Department of the Soviet Intelligence Service. He was then transferred to Finland, where, undercover as vice consul in the Soviet embassy in Helsinki, he worked on counterintelligence matters until his break with the regime in December 1961. By 1956, he was already beginning to be disillusioned with the Soviet system. The Hungarian events of that year intensified his disaffection. He concluded that the only practical way to fight the regime was from abroad and that, armed with his inside knowledge of the KGB, he would be able to do so effectively. Having reached his decision, he began systematically to elicit and commit to memory information that he thought would be relevant and valuable to the West. The adoption of the new, aggressive long-range communist policy precipitated his decision to break with the regime. He felt that the necessity of warning the West of the new dimensions of the threat that it was facing justified him in abandoning his country and facing the personal sacrifices involved. His break with the regime was a deliberate and long premeditated political act. Immediately on his arrival in the United States, he sought to convey a warning to the highest authorities in the U.S. government on the new political dangers to the Western world stemming from the harnessing of all the political resources of the communist bloc, including its intelligence and security services, to the new long-range policy. From 1962 onward, the author devoted a large proportion of his time to the study of communist affairs as an outside observer reading both the communist and Western press. He began work on this book. While working on the book, he continued to bring to the attention of American and other Western authorities his views on the issues considered in it, and in 1968 allowed American and British officials to read the manuscript as it then stood. Although the manuscript has since been enlarged to cover the events of the last decade and revised as the underlying communist strategy became clearer to the author, the substance of the argument has changed little since 1968. Owing to the length of the manuscript, a substantial part of it has been held over for publication at a later date. With few exceptions, those Western officials who were aware of the views expressed in the manuscript, especially on the Sino-Soviet split, rejected them. In fact, over the years it became increasingly clear to the author that there was no reasonable hope of his analysis of communist affairs being seriously considered in Western official circles. At the same time, he became further convinced that events continued to confirm the validity of his analysis, that the threat from international communism was not properly understood, and that this threat would shortly enter a new and more dangerous phase. The author therefore decided to publish his work with the intention of alerting a wider sector of world public opinion to the dangers as he sees them, in the hope of stimulating a new approach to the study of communism and of provoking a more coherent, determined, and effective response to it by those who remain interested in the preservation of free societies in the non-communist world. In order to give effect to his decision to publish, the author asked the four of us, all former U.S. or British government officials, for editorial advice and help. Three of us have known the author and his views for 12 years or more. We can testify to his Sisyphean efforts to convince others of the validity of what he has to say. We have the highest regard for his personal and professional integrity. The value of his services to national security has been officially recognized by more than one government in the West. Despite the rejection of his views by many of our former colleagues, we continue to believe that the contents of this book are of the greatest importance and relevance to a proper understanding of contemporary events. We were, therefore, more than willing to respond to the author's request for help in editing his manuscript for publication. And we commend the book for the most serious study by all who are interested in relations between the communist and non-communist worlds. The preparation of the manuscript has been undertaken by the author with the help of each of us, acting in an individual and private capacity. The author is a citizen of the United States of America and an honorary commander of the Order of the British Empire, CBE. Stephen de Mowbray Arthur Martin Vasia C. Gmurkin Scott Myler. Author's note. This book is the product of nearly 20 years of my life. It presents my convictions that, throughout that period, the West has misunderstood the nature of changes in the communist world and has been misled and outmaneuvered by communist guile. My researches have not only strengthened my belief, but have led me to a new methodology by which to analyze communist actions. This methodology takes into account the dialectical character of communist strategic thinking. It is my hope that the methodology will come to be used by students of communist affairs throughout the Western world. I accept sole responsibility for the contents of the book. In writing it, I have received no assistance of any kind from any government or other organization. I submitted the text to the appropriate U.S. authorities, who raised no objection to its publication on grounds of national security. For the transliteration of Russian names, I have used the system adopted by U.S. government agencies. The transliteration of Chinese names follows the old system. I wish to thank my friends, Stephen de Mowbray and Arthur Martin, who did the lion's share of the editing and helped me throughout with their editorial advice. I thank, too, Vasia C. Gmurkin and Scott Myler for their contributions to editing and for their editorial advice. I am grateful to PC, PW, RH, PH, and AK for their dedication in typing the manuscript, to the wives of my friends who suffered in silence during its preparation, and especially to my wife, Svetlana, for her encouragement and her forbearance. I wish to express my deep gratitude to two of my American friends, who will remain unnamed, for their help and their efforts in bringing my manuscript to the attention of the publishers, Dodd, Mead & Company. The publishers deserve my admiration for their grasp of the significance of the manuscript and for having the courage to publish such a controversial book. I am especially grateful to Alan Klotz of Dodd, Mead & Company, who revealed a great personal interest in the publication and also made the final editing of the manuscript. Finally, I thank the Soviet government and party for the excellent educational facilities that made this book possible. And I thank Russian history and literature for the inspiration they gave when guiding me toward my decision of conscience to serve the people rather than the party. Anatoly Golitsyn. Men will not receive the truth from their enemies, and it is very seldom offered to them by their friends. On this very account, I have frankly uttered it. Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, New Lies for Old. Attributed to Anna Akhmatova. Part 1. The Two Methodologies. 1. The Problems Facing Western Analysts. The non-communist world devotes considerable effort to the study of the communist world, and rightly so, since Western policy toward the communist world is based on Western assessments of the situation therein. Many institutions have sprung up in the United States, Great Britain, France, and elsewhere to study communist problems. Apart from traditional historical studies of pre-revolutionary Russia and China, new specialties have been invented, such as Sovietology or the more limited Kremlinology, which study the policy-making level in the Soviet Union. Analogous specialties have been established in the fields of China watching and East European studies. The results of Western studies are valid only if two sorts of difficulty are successfully overcome. The general difficulties stemming from the concern for secrecy displayed by communist regimes and the special difficulties arising from their use of disinformation. The failure of current Western studies is due in large part to the failure to appreciate the second set of difficulties. The general difficulties and obstacles in the way of Western studies derive from the nature of communist regimes and are broadly recognized in the West. Principal among these difficulties are special measures taken to prevent leakage of secret information relating to problems of policy making and its execution, such as the payment of a 15% salary supplement to KGB officers for maintaining secrecy. The existence of immensely powerful security service resources devoted to protecting state secrets and suppressing true freedom of expression. The party and state monopoly over the publishing and communications media and the dissemination of information for both internal and external consumption. Effective control and observation of foreign embassies, journalists, and visitors to communist countries and of their contacts in those countries. In principle, these measures are not new. They are the concomitants of all totalitarian systems, which apply them with varying techniques and degrees of efficiency. Although these difficulties complicate the study in the West of communist regimes and policies, they do not make it impossible. Western scholars have accumulated experience in dealing with the difficulties. The eyewitness accounts of many former inhabitants of the communist world now resident in the West have proved extremely helpful to the serious study of communist regimes and their problems in the past. Point 1. If these general difficulties were the only ones, Western assessments of the situation in the communist world might be more or less accurate. However, there are other special difficulties. The special difficulties, disinformation. The special difficulties derive from the deliberate efforts of communist governments to mislead and misdirect Western studies and assessments. These deliberate efforts are known as disinformation, in Russian, дезинформация. The great Soviet encyclopedia says that the word is taken from two French roots, de, implying removal or elimination, and information, meaning knowledge. Point 2. The GC defines disinformation as the dissemination through press and radio of false data with the purpose of misleading public opinion. It goes on to say that the capitalist press and radio broadly use disinformation to deceive the people of the world and to portray the new war that the Anglo-American imperialist bloc are preparing as defensive and the peaceful policy of the Soviet Union and the people's democracies as aggressive. This would have been a broadly accurate definition of disinformation if the alleged roles of the imperialist and Soviet blocs had been reversed. In fact, disinformation has been used to a varying extent throughout the history of the Soviet Union. This book is primarily concerned with the communist use of strategic disinformation. The term means a systematic effort to disseminate false information and to distort or withhold information so as to misrepresent the real situation in and policies of the communist world and thereby to confuse, deceive, and influence the non-communist world, to jeopardize its policies, and to induce Western adversaries to contribute unwittingly to the achievement of communist objectives. Since 1958, a program of strategic political disinformation operations has been brought into effect. Its purpose has been to create favorable conditions for the implementation of long-range communist bloc policy, to impede the adoption of effective countermeasures or policies by the non-communist world, and to secure strategic gains for world communism. An understanding of the disinformation program is crucial to a correct analysis of the situation in the communist world, but its existence has been either ignored or discounted in the West. An attempt will be made in this book to explain, on the basis of the author's inside information and new methodology, the role of the disinformation program and the techniques employed in it. Disinformation in communist regimes. It is not only by communist governments that disinformation is practiced. Nevertheless, disinformation plays a more significant role in communist regimes than in any other type. Its role is determined by the particular ways in which communist regimes respond to crises within their systems, by the unlimited extent of communist external objectives, and by the communist capacity for executing a worldwide, long-term, offensive political strategy. The role of disinformation in communist regimes can be clarified by comparing communist and democratic systems in the manner in which they respond to internal crises and in the nature of their external policies. In democratic societies, internal crises are usually open and limited in their extent. A democratic system allows for the absorption of the forces of popular resentment through democratic elections, judicial processes, and flexible responses in the form of negotiation and mediation. For this reason, political or social protest movements do not normally lead to revolts of the entire population against the regime. Crises usually result in some readjustments in the system and may seal the fate of individual politicians, groups, or parties, but the basic stability of the system remains unaffected. This kind of flexible, democratic response could be seen in the United States during the campaign against the Vietnam War and during the Watergate crisis and in France after the events of May 1968. In communist regimes, crises are usually hidden from the outside world. Because of the absence of democratic processes and the suppression of internal opposition, popular political, social, and economic discontents accumulate and threaten to develop into serious upheavals or revolts of the entire population against the system as a whole. This happened in Hungary in 1956. The manner of solving such a crisis in a communist system is normally arbitrary and authoritarian. As far as external policies are concerned, those of non-communist countries are normally dictated by national interest and have limited, short-term objectives. Except in time of war, they are usually defensive. Democratic governments deal directly with the governments of other countries and are constrained in their dealings with the opposition except in the event of civil war. Democratic governments tend to be either disinclined or unprepared to take advantage of crises in other countries that they may or may not regard as adversaries. Communist external policy, on the other hand, is global, ideological, and long-range, and has the final objective of world domination. It is inherently inclined to take the initiative unless it is forced onto the defensive by an extraordinary combination of circumstances. Whatever the appearances, communist foreign policy also tends to place considerable emphasis on its dealings with the extreme left-wing opposition to the established government as well as on its dealings with the government itself. Communism is always inclined, and usually prepared, to take advantage of any crisis in a non-communist country. It is required to do so by its long-term, unlimited objectives. The differences between communist and non-communist systems in their reactions to internal crises and in their external policies determine the different roles of disinformation in their respective systems. Democratic systems, being more open and therefore inherently more stable politically, do not need disinformation to hide the internal crises that occur from time to time and the means by which they are resolved. Crises become common knowledge and cannot be concealed. The Watergate crisis is a case in point. The main condition for the successful solution of such a crisis is that it should become public knowledge. Therefore, there is no place for disinformation. Although democratic governments do manage news to some extent to project a better image of their performance, the use of special clandestine methods for internal purposes is liable to be disclosed and exploited by the opposition in the next election campaign. In external policy, democratic governments may practice disinformation on a limited scale in pursuit of their limited, national, and normally defensive objectives. But such disinformation tends to be on a modest scale and restricted to the military and counterintelligence fields. In communist regimes, the role of disinformation is entirely different. It is conditioned in part by the inherent instability of communist systems. The political vulnerability of communist regimes, their concern for stability, and their undemocratic methods of resolving internal crises oblige them to use disinformation on a wide scale in order to conceal and dispel the threats to their existence and to present themselves in a favorable light as stable forms of society. The internal role of disinformation is, on the one hand, to conceal the undemocratic, anti-national, unlawful, and even criminal methods of resolving internal crises and, on the other, to minimize or neutralize internal anti-regime activities while at the same time preventing or neutralizing any attempt from outside to foment and exploit those activities. The special role of disinformation is enhanced by the aggressive and ambitious character of communist external policy. This aims at promoting and establishing communist regimes in non-communist countries throughout the world by giving support to the extreme left-wing opposition, by gaining temporary political allies, by exploiting and deepening whatever internal crises may occur, and even by creating artificial crises. In order to be successful, such a policy needs a cloak or screen to mask or distort its specific objectives, tactics, and maneuvers while at the same time it creates favorable conditions in the countries concerned for the achievement of its goals. Disinformation provides this cloak or screen and also a means of exerting influence. It is the combination of aggressiveness with disinformation that gives communist policy its conspiratorial character. This combination is not a matter of speculation but an existing and constant reality in communist activity that cannot be arbitrarily ignored by Western governments and scholars without affecting the accuracy and realism of their assessments of the communist world. The scope and scale of disinformation activity by communist regimes is virtually unlimited. There are no legal or political obstacles to disinformation operations. A police state with its centralized authority, its total control over resources, its untrammeled ability to execute maneuvers and sudden shifts in policy, and its immunity from the pressures of organized public opinion offers tremendous advantages for disinformation operations as compared with a democratic system. Given total control over the communications media, communist governments need have no fear of adverse publicity. They can say one thing in public and do the opposite in private with complete impunity. They can also use for disinformation purposes the facilities of their intelligence and security services, which operate on a scale and with an immunity unparalleled in the West. Given these advantages, it is not surprising that communist regimes should engage in disinformation at a state level as a significant part of their activities. They have unlimited opportunities to practice total disinformation, that is to say, to use all possible types of and channels for disinformation. Communist disinformation operations are controlled at the highest level of government. They serve to support the interests of long-range policy, and their forms, patterns, and objectives are therefore determined by the nature of the policy in any given period. In assessing the potentialities of communist strategic disinformation, it should be remembered that during the Second World War, the Western Allies showed themselves capable of devising ingenious and effective military and strategic deception operations. The three main conditions for the success of these operations were the existence of clearly defined and agreed Allied war aims, the wartime system of press and radio censorship, and the insight the Allies had gained into German intelligence, particularly through their ability to decipher German communications. In 1958-60, the communist regimes enjoyed comparable conditions and advantages in relation to the West.